When she was 8 years old, Karen Weir Jimerson started saving up money for a horse. She was going to stable it under the stairs and ride it around her subdivision. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. By the time she was 16, the horse money seemed like it would be better spent on a car, but she never gave up her dream. Today, she lives in rural Iowa on a 3-acre farm she shares with one husband, two sons, three horses, four donkeys, 12 sheep, six dogs, 13 cats, 25 chickens, and six doves. She's written about her adventures in So Much Sky, essays on the fun and folly of living in the country. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Karen Weir Jimerson lives with her family on a 3-acre farm outside of Des Moines, but she wasn't always a country girl. She's written about the discoveries she's made about country life in a new book of essays called So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. She's also the author of the Slow Lane column for Country Gardens magazine and has written a number of books about gardening, and she's here with us today. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in West Des Moines, a suburb of Des Moines, and so I have a suburban background. And then I went to the University of Iowa, and then after that I moved to Boston and South Carolina. And so I kind of lived a bunch of different places, and then I came back to Iowa.
So you weren't too far from the country, though, growing up. You knew about it.
You know, physically, I wasn't very far from the country. But I have to say, I never went out into the country. I grew up in a suburban neighborhood. We didn't know anyone who lived in the country. And so, it might have been, 5 miles for us to be out in the country. But we just never had that experience.
In one of your essays, you write about when you were 8 years old and you announced to your parents that you were going to get a horse. And it was more of an announcement than a request. But where do you think that dream came from?
Well, do you know any 8-year-old little girl that doesn't want a horse? I just loved horses, and I just loved the concept of horses in theory, although I hadn't ever been around them. I just thought they were beautiful animals. And so I really, really wanted one. Plus, a friend of mine had a horse, and so we would go out to the stables.
And you had a whole plan for how you were going to have a horse at your house.
I did. I had imagined, actually, I measured the area beneath the stairway in the basement, and I determined that a smallish horse could fit there. And so that was my plan, and I kind of, set it out to my parents, and they were like, no, that's not going to work.
So you were going to stable it in the basement.
Yes.
And ride it around the subdivision.
Up the stairs, yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
It did to me at the time.
What I love about that story is, though, as we get on into our conversation, that really set a precedent for you and your interaction with animals and your life. You have always found a way.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the title of the book, So Much Sky, because you grew up in Iowa. You know about the Iowa sky. But when you moved to Boston, when you lived elsewhere and you came back to Iowa, did you see the state in a different way?
You know, I did. I mean, it's such a beautiful place. And for me to, every time I came back, I was just so in awe of just how beautiful Iowa is. The sky, everything about the, just flying into the Des Moines airport and seeing just that patchwork, that real symmetrical patchwork of land below. And then everything just being so green in the summertime. So, yeah, I think it's just an amazingly gorgeous place.
And where did the phrase So Much Sky come from?
Well, it actually came from my mother-in-law. She is from Brooklyn, or she was from Brooklyn. And she and my father-in-law came out to visit. And they did not come very often. And they got a Winnebago, and they drove across the country. And they got here, and I think when she got out, I mean, she'd been looking out the window, presumably, from New York to Iowa. But when she got out, she was so taken, and actually she kind of cowered a little bit with just how much sky there was. And so she could, that's what she said. She goes, oh, my God, there's so much sky here. You know, how can you stand it? You know, and it, and we just laughed about that for years because, you know, it's like, well, it's the same amount of sky, I think, that you have. But it's not, of course, because there's nothing that obstructs the view.
Right. Here. Right. Well, and I think growing up in Iowa, it's very easy to take it for granted. And I lived out of the state for 10 years. And even just visiting home, it was just so wonderful to be able to see the sky. And I promised myself I would never take it for granted again.
Excellent.
And I have a friend who grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and she said that this kind of sky makes her feel like a hawk's going to just come down and pluck her up. So that idea of cowering, I think your mother-in-law is not alone in that feeling. So you and your husband moved to this little acreage, 3 acres in the country. Describe the land and the house for me.
Well, first of all, actually, my husband lived there when I met him. And so I can't take any credit for finding this little sort of piece of heaven. But the house itself was built in 1903, and it's a 4-square farmhouse, kind of a traditional farmhouse, 4 rooms on the bottom, 4 rooms on the top. And so it's basically a big square, and it's built like right on, you know, on the prairie, which is now, you know, corn and soybean fields. There's a little bit of a pasture nearby that we use. And it's just, you know, it's just your traditional farmhouse.
So your husband must have been driven by a dream of living in the country, too. Did he grow up in Brooklyn?
No, he grew up in New Jersey. And, you know, it's funny because if you come to our house, the thing that sort of might sort of stick in the back of your head would be, this looks like a farm set. And in fact, that's exactly what, you know, Doug, you know, had in mind, I think, when he bought it. I mean, he played with farm sets when he was a kid, even though he lived in New Jersey outside of right across the bridge from New York. And but he wanted a farm. And so, you know, we have like the, you know, white buildings and the, you know, the red barn or actually we have a white barn. But we have, you know, basically a farm set. We live in a farm set.
And the house is over 100 years old.
Yes.
You have a wonderful essay, and I'd love for you to read it for us, that tells a little bit about what it's like to move onto a property that has been lived on by so many other people for so many years before you've gotten there. And that essay is called Mayflowers.
Yes. Okay. The calendar says it's spring, and so do the red-winged blackbirds busily clamoring in the ditches searching for nesting materials. In Iowa, winter can linger through April like an unpleasant house guest who's packed up the car to leave but stands in the driveway to chat inanely for a while longer. But May, lovely May, is safely out of bounds for winter. And nearly overnight, in Oz-like fashion, our yard sheds winter's austerity. The divas of the spring garden, lilac and peony, burst into bloom. Showy, large-headed, and sublimely fragrant, the lilacs and peonies grow in this yard thanks not to Doug's or my good planning and labor, but to the gardeners who lived in this 4-square farmhouse a long time ago. When our house was built in 1903, it must have been an imposing figure on the landscape. Rising 2 stories from the earth, the white frame house with its sloping green roof cast a large boxy shadow on the treeless prairie around it. And so the owners set to planting parallel rows of silver maples for a windbreak on the north side of the house. On the sunny south side, they created circular beds of colorful and fragrant shrubs and perennials. With the faith in the future that gardening teaches, these believers and those who lived in the house after them planted small lilac saplings along fence rows and gnarled peony roots beside the driveway. They dropped to their knees and sifted through the soil with the expectation of spring bouquets, summer bounties, fall wonders. But did they envision that someone like me might be waxing poetic about the fruits, or more appropriately, the flowers of their labors in the following century? If there are ghosts on an old farmstead, surely one of the places they exist is in the landscape. The rambling roses, the flowering quinces, the phlox, as well as the peonies and lilacs, all tell a story of our home's former inhabitants, who surrounded themselves with their idea of order and beauty. It's lovely to think that these gardeners linger on in the unfurling of a rosebud or in the fragrance of phlox. Ah, if only these spirits could weed the garden. What variety are these peonies, people ask me when they see them abloom in the side yard. but I found no name for them. Perhaps they didn't sell well decades ago, so these peonies can't be found in any gardening catalog of today. Just barely pink and with a frilly head of petals, this peony has bloomed reliably for years and is one of my favorites, but has somehow fallen out of favor with the rest of the world. It's the same story for the phlox in our garden. Tall, fragrant, and unencumbered with the mildew problems that can plague modern phlox cultivars. Our lavender phloxes also have mystery names, mystery origins. Yet their namelessness doesn't bother them, and they return year after year without any care or concern from us. These and many other old-fashioned flowers make up the hundreds of varieties that once graced the dooryard gardens of turn-of-the-century homes but are no longer in commercial cultivation. Perennial flowers are sometimes the very last remnants of long-gone farmsteads, the bright whispers in the landscape that tell the story of a once-bustling piece of land, a land that supported people and animals who joined together to work it, a land that was well-tended and decorated with the flowers that still stubbornly bloom each year. If you look hard as you drive through the countryside, you may see vestiges of gardens, the phlox spires that bloom midsummer amid the wooden wreckage of an old house, the towering canes of flower-studded hollyhocks, the roses scrambling across the ground in full bloom. There is such a place near our house. The vacant farmstead was purchased by the highway department to allow for a much-welcomed road widening project. The house and buildings, or the outbuildings, were raised, but curiously, at the far end of the property sits an upturned chicken house. In late spring, right on schedule, a circle of orange-red oriental poppies sends up their fragile-looking crepe paper blooms through the weeds and tall grass that stand between the highway's edge and the sideways-lying chicken house. The startling color and the persistent blooms always catch me off guard and make me smile. What determination in plant form. So as I head into a new gardening season, I keep in mind that our garden is a shared experience with the past and future, that the daylily I plant today is part of a larger garden plan that is not my own. The trumpet-shaped yellow-orange daylily blooms will carry on a tradition of setting down roots and naming the place that they bloom. Home.
Karen Weir Jimerson reading an essay called Mayflowers from her book of essays called So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. And Karen, we're going to take a break here, but then we'll come back and talk more about your experiences living in rural Iowa in just a moment. And we want to hear from you as well. If you grew up in rural Iowa, if you live in rural Iowa now, we'd love to know what you've learned from living in the country and what thoughts you'd like to share with other people who may not have had that experience. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Karen Weir Jimerson. She's the author of a collection of essays called So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. And she lives on a three-acre acreage farmstead just outside of Des Moines with her husband and her two sons and many animals. And Karen, that essay about Mayflowers, I just love the idea that when you live on one of these rural properties where you're in the old farmhouse and you are gardening on the same ground that people have gardened for 100 years, that you're constantly interacting with the past. Is that something you think about when you're out there planting flowers?
Well, I do, because there are a lot of varieties, as I mentioned in the essay, that are already growing there, and somebody planted them. And I think about, you know, what they were thinking about when they were planting those flowers and just sort of, you know, creating a landscape that was pleasing to them. I think that's really interesting, because everywhere you go, that's happening. It just becomes very obvious when you're out in the middle of nowhere planting.
Do you feel a responsibility to the people who have come before?
Well, sort of. I mean, I sort of feel like we've done a good job with the house. We've updated it, but we've kept the integrity of the house. And whoever designed the house and laid the floor and did everything the way that they felt was the best way to build a house. We've honored that by sort of trying to keep everything in sort of the same way. So, yeah, I do think about it a lot.
There are other ways that the past makes itself known. One of the essays that you wrote was about doing archaeological digs with your son, or with both of your sons. And for people who haven't lived on a farmstead, that may surprise them a little bit, but you and your sons would go out and you could basically scratch the surface and find all kinds of things that had been buried.
Yeah, I mean, the frost just pushes stuff up out of the ground, you know, stones. And then, of course, anything that was ever laid on the ground, you know, in the past, you know, well, forever, you know, has the potential of coming up. And so we would find the weirdest things. We would find silverware. We would find plate shards. We found a pair of glasses once, you know, old wire rim glasses, all sorts of farm pieces or farm implement pieces that we had no idea what they were. We would just put them out and eventually someone would wander in and go, oh, you know what that is, and tell us. But we would just walk through the woods basically with a rake, just dragging a rake behind us. And when we heard a clink, we'd stop and dig it up.
Oh, how interesting. And what did your sons think about that? How did they think about that stuff?
Well, my one son, Graham, sort of became obsessed with what was out there, you know, and so he wanted a metal detector, which we got for his birthday. But then we were laughing because it was like it was going off all the time. You know, there was just so much stuff there. And we were envisioning, oh, my gosh, there's probably a Buick buried, you know, here or a tractor. I mean, so they were just finding stuff all the time. We have boxes of all the stuff that they pulled up out of the ground.
Boxes and boxes of treasure, I suppose.
And I think they thought they were going to find something really valuable, you know. And in a way, they did. You know, they were sort of unearthing the past.
And did they ask you about how people used to live there before when they would unearth these things?
Yeah, they would. I mean, we would pull up stuff and they would be like, what do you think this is? You know, and I frankly had no ideas, you know, because I don't, you know, I'm not from a farming background and I don't know what some of these implements were. But we started finding things and pulling them up and our neighbor would tell us, would come down and, you know, tell us what things were. They were, you know, pieces of tractors or pieces of plows and that type of thing. So I mean, then they started thinking about how, you know, the land was worked and how it's worked differently now.
You have a number of dogs. You have six dogs right now?
Actually, we just have five because we just lost
sorry.
One. No, that's okay.
So you share your life with five dogs, which
yes.
is a lot of dogs.
It is.
Did you have dogs growing up?
We had one really ill-mannered Cocker Spaniel when I was growing up. And so he's, you know, that was kind of like having a lot of dogs because, you know, he was kind of a bad dog. But we just had one. I just had one dog growing up. And so having five dogs seems like a lot on any given day when they're all running around. But for the most part, it's not that many.
Well, and your dogs are a number of different breeds, and so you interact with them in different ways.
We have sort of like the gift pack of dogs. We have a large dog, a Great Pyrenees named Alba, and we've always had Great Pyrenees. I like that breed quite a bit. They're big, calm, goofy dogs. And then we have Border Collies because we use them to work our sheep. So we have three Border Collies, some with varying sheep herding skills. And then we have two Jack Russells, and they're just nuts. You know, that is our group of five. So it's a tall, a medium, and two small.
And had you had any experience with Border Collies before you adopted your first one?
No. And they are such smart dogs. And we were kind of shocked about how smart they were. The first Border Collie we got was a dog named Rose. And she was just an amazing sheep herder. She had the instinct. She immediately herded all of our farm cats into a big circle. When she was a puppy, you know, she would herd them, which farm cats don't like that at all. But she was just had the instinct and the eye, and we had her go to a Border Collie trainer to kind of fine-tune her a little bit. But she was splendid. She could, you know, and she could gather up the sheep in, you know, in just a small period of time. And my husband actually worked with sort of the old Scottish, you know, come by and wait to me sort of sheep herding calls. But What I used to do is just say, Rose, the sheep are out, go get them. And she would just do it, you know, and bring them all back in.
Well, I love what you wrote at the end of the essay that you write about her, that every connection that you make in life, even with a dog, teaches you something. So here's the wisdom that Rose has imparted to me, that speed and superiority can come without swagger, that life is good if there's as much joy in work as in play, that true passion can ignite your life forever, and that you should never pass up the opportunity to sneak in a nap. I thought that was really beautiful. And I want to go to a caller who is calling us from Columbia, and his name is Chance, and I believe that's a name that comes up in your book. So, hello, Chance.
Hey, how's it going? I'm in Columbia.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for calling. And you're a friend of the family, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Woodward. They lived outside of town. I was a townie. So, of course, found out that Karen was going to be on the show today. I'm actually in Barranquilla, Colombia right now with the Peace Corps. We're the first group to return to the country in 30 years. They had a security issue back in the 80s. So, yeah. How's it going?
Hi, Chance.
So you were influenced to be doing what you're doing today, Chance, by Karen?
Yeah, I just wanted to call in because I don't know if Karen is really pimping herself out, if I could use that phrase, as much as she should. Growing up in a small Iowa town, you know, I love my friends that I have from my small Iowa town, but people didn't travel the world a lot. They didn't know about a lot of these exotic places. And so I grew up with Karen's oldest son, Tristan, as my best friend, you know, all through school, and they would just go on these trips, and they would write about it, and they would tell me about it. And I think the best way to kind of show what I mean is Karen writes about me in her book. And Karen, do you want to tell that story about how I didn't quite understand how food works?
Well, we have a garden, and we, you know, raise a lot of our own food. And so, you know, Chance would come, and I would be trying to, of course, get all the boys to eat vegetables. And so I remember standing, rinsing a bowl of arugula out to make dinner that I just harvested 2 seconds earlier in the garden. I mean, how wonderful is that? And Chance is like, don't you have enough cash to buy this at the grocery store? You know, and so then I sat down and talked to him about local food issues to the point where he probably just wanted to, you know, run away.
Well, you...
But now, yeah... After that, you know, I love fresh salad from the garden, you know, so it's interesting to see how I've grown up with them. And I think people like Karen, the ones who could leave Iowa if they wanted to, but have chosen to stay in Iowa for the reasons that she's mentioned, they are also what makes Iowa a great place to live and a great place to be from.
Well, Chance, thank you so much for calling, and I hope you have a wonderful time in Columbia, and I hope you come back, too.
You bet. Yeah. And if you're interested, you can check out, I actually do a podcast at chancedorland.com.
All right. Thanks a lot. So, Karen, you had the opportunity to interact with kids like Chance and other kids who grew up in town and had sort of the similar experience to what you experienced when you were a child. I mean, you're sons would bring friends home who didn't have any familiarity with what it was like to live in the country. Did you try to use that as a teaching opportunity?
Well, sort of. You know, I feel like if kids can sort of be out in the world and see, like, for example, gardening. I mean, don't get me started on gardening, because I sort of feel like if you can plant something and grow something, you see the world in a totally different way. And I felt like that was something I wanted to share with my kids and their friends as well. So I would have them go out and help me gather food or collect eggs, because we had laying chickens. And just be out in the world, because it's such a beautiful place. And you know, they were very, you know, they were boys and they were kids, and they, you know, wanted to be on electronics and have a lot of screen time and stuff like that. And so there was, you know, constantly going, let's just turn everything off and go outside. And, you know, so I apparently that worked.
That's great.
Who knew?
Right. It's nice to get some positive
right.
feedback on that. Well, you have a lot of animals with you on the farm. Where did that start? What were the first animals that you and your husband got together?
We actually we kept looking out at all this grass, and we kept thinking there has to be a way to use this. And so sheep, you know, was the obvious answer. And so we, you know, did what all people who, you know, don't know anything about think we bought books. We bought books on, you know, there's a Story Publishing does this great series on all sorts of ways to raise different types of livestock. So we bought sheep, Raising Sheep the Modern Way, and read it and read it again and read it again. And then we bought two pregnant ewes, and the rest is history.
So you have a very close relationship with the animals on your farm, but you also raise them for meat. Was that a difficult relationship for you to wrap your mind around as someone who grew up buying your meat from the grocery store?
Yes, it was really weird, because one of the things that we had growing up, my mom loved lamb, and we would have lamb every Easter. We would only have it on Easter. It was a very big deal to have this lamb on Easter. And so we, you know, when I was raised, you know, I was like, we can raise it. You know, how awesome is this? And so, but when we first sent our little ram lambs off to market, it was really hard. It was really awful. And we sort of, you know, all had to come to the decision about whether or not we were going to be carnivores, and this, because this is what the proposition is. But we, you know, these are domesticated animals, and we decided that we wanted to do that. We wanted to raise our own meat, and so we did do that. But it was not without a lot of soul searching and you know, making decisions that, frankly, I never had to ever do when I bought something in the grocery store.
How did you explain it to your boys? Because I'm sure little lambs are adorable and fun, and it must have been hard for them to conceive.
It was. And they were, it was hard, I think. And part of the time they were kind of clueless, you know, about what was, you know, sort of happening. But then when they sort of did understand what was happening, I think they had to come to it in their own ways. And they're both still meat eaters today. So, you know, I think our emphasis was that we can treat these animals humanely. We can raise organic food. You know, this is what old farmsteads did, you know, 100 years ago. And that's kind of what we were trying to, you know, emulate that model to a certain extent.
We have an email from Nick. He says, I'm originally from Dubuque, but I now live in Chicago. I've been trying subtly to convince my wife to move to rural eastern Iowa. I know I have a romantic notion of country living. For you, what was the most jarring or challenging aspect of settling in a rural setting?
Well, I think initially when I moved out to the farm, and really we're only 35 miles from Des Moines, but, you know, I had lived in a place like, for example, Boston, where I could walk out my door and go out to eat, or I could walk out my door and go see a movie. And neither of those things can, you know, we do at the farm. We have to plan things. Now, of course, I've been living out there a long time, and so it's not sort of the imposition that it first had seemed to be. The other thing is that there's so much of the world that can come to us now. You know, we can watch. We have a satellite dish. I mean, we're, you know, linked into the modern world in a way that everybody else is linked into the modern world. We have a DSL line. But I think that the first thing was just how far away everything was. And the idea that a spontaneous thing like going out to eat is not spontaneous.
It must feel like the world is farther away, though, in the winter months.
Yes, very much so, because the world just sort of comes to a crashing stop, especially if there's a huge snowstorm. And you do feel, I mean, we've been snowed in a number of times. We actually were coming back from a trip and we were snowed out for the first time ever. We had to leave our car on our road and hike into our house one January. And so, yeah, you definitely pay attention to weather in a way that you don't, I think, when I lived in town.
There must be some nice things about that feeling, too, though, are there?
Well, there's definitely. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, walking out into the wide open spaces after a snowstorm is like heaven must be, you know. I mean, it's just so amazingly beautiful. And so that beauty is definitely worth it.
We're going to have to take a break here. When we get back, I want to talk a little bit about your experiences with horses. You have, as I mentioned earlier, you have sheep, You have horses, donkeys, which yes. You don't actually write that much about the donkeys in your books. I'd love to find out more.
They're so
smart. Right? And you also have cats, chickens, doves, and of course, you're there with your husband and your two sons. So we'll talk more in just a moment. My guest today is Karen Weir Jimerson. She's the author of So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. She's also a columnist. It's her day job. She writes the Slow Lane column for Country Gardens magazine. She's also written a number of books about gardening, including Better Homes and Gardens, From Garden to Plate, and Better Homes and Gardens, Herb Gardening. We'd love to hear from you as well today. If you grew up in the country and find yourself constantly explaining to other people what it was like to live in the country, we'd love to hear some of the things that you tell people about it. Or if you live in the country now, we'd love to hear your stories. What have you learned from living in rural Iowa? How has it made you the person you are today? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Karen Weir Jimerson. She's the author of a new book of essays called So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. And we'd love to hear from you today as well. If you grew up in rural Iowa, if you live in rural Iowa now, we'd love to hear about your experiences and what you tell other people about why you live in the country. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have a Facebook comment from Shane who says that I love being able to pee off the front porch without any neighbors seeing me, but I hate driving 15 miles to get a good cup of coffee. So there's certainly some tremendous perks to the privacy of living in the country. And one of the very interesting things that you write about in a number of different ways in your book are the people that you come into contact with that you would not have ever come into contact with living in town. And one of those people is the man who comes to shear your sheep.
Yes. Well, we have to have a number of people come and do different things because they're very specialized, very specialized endeavors. Shearing sheep is really hard, and we would end up getting all cut up. And our sheep shearer, Bill Stabler, came to our farm for years and sheared our six sheep, which was, we were kind of small potatoes in the sheep, raising community. It was fun. We would always have a sheep shearing breakfast because it's so enjoyable to watch a sheep get sheared, I think, for everyone but the sheep. And it's a very cool skill. And so we would invite all of our friends out and we'd have a big breakfast and watch the sheep get sheared and then have breakfast.
You also write about having the farrier come. And I guess not being a horse person, I didn't even know there were still farriers in Iowa.
There has to be farriers because basically horses need pedicures about every 6 weeks. And so, so our farrier comes out and does clips the hooves of our three horses. And it's very interesting, too, because that's an old sort of, career. And he goes from farm to farm or from ranch to ranch, whoever has horses, and does this. And so he gets to have a real keen sense of what's going on in the world, at least in the rural world, which is I always find it fascinating to talk to him because he does talk to everyone so, intimately while he's out there working on his horses.
And a tremendous source of news for you.
Yes, definitely.
The other person that comes into your essays, and here's another career that's all but lost, is the man who came to fix your windmill.
Yes, this is Jim Ball calls himself the windmill man, which is exactly what he does. And he, it's he's just obsessed with windmills, and he wants them all to be fixed and working again. And so basically, I got his name from a friend, and I called him up, and I said, you know, you don't know me, but I have this windmill on our property. And we, it was a working, you know, water pumping windmill, but the head had been taken off of it, but we had all the pieces to it. So I called him up, and he, you know, said, oh, I can't possibly come out, I'm so busy. And then, okay, I'll be there in 10 minutes. And then there he was, you know, and he just scampered right up to the top of the windmill, and which just scared me to death because it's so tall and no one had been up there, you know. And so basically he assessed the whole situation and ended up fixing it, which is a big deal because he had to come with a crane and lay it down and then put the head back on it and pick it back up again. And It was kind of an ordeal, but it works.
Okay, it works. It moves, but do you have it hooked up to anything?
Actually, that's like the next step. We just wanted it to be moving, and we there is a pump that is beneath it that we could pump water, but we'd have to do some other things on the farm in order to actually use that water, so we don't have it hooked up.
We have a number of callers on the line who want to talk about their rural Iowa experiences. Jeff is on the line right now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, what's your experience?
Well, I grew up in a rural bedroom community. Didn't really, you know, grow up on a farm. Worked for farmers throughout my teens and then moved away for 25 years, living in metropolitan areas where I raised my children, Des Moines, Atlanta, Las Vegas, and Birmingham, Alabama. And recently, last year, moved back and bought 8 acres in a rural community, an old farmhouse. And just really has changed my life from living in a metropolitan area to move back. And probably the biggest thing is my adult children now come home, and really I bought it as an interim home, and they've fallen in love with it. To be able to come there, it's a destination place and almost a family unwinding place where the adult kids and grandchildren can come and look at the stars and listen to coyotes and just relax. And they're like, you know, don't ever get rid of this property, Dad. And so it's changed everybody's life a little bit.
Oh, that's wonderful, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that.
In
contrast, Harold's on the line from Luther. And Harold, you have a niece who doesn't enjoy rural Iowa quite so much.
Yes. So today we're out building a chicken house. We had a fire. We had a enjoying this nice winter weather and the sun and rebuilding this. But when I heard the title to the book, it made me think of my niece who was visiting from California. I lived in the country my whole life, and it never would have occurred to me how someone like that might react. And we were enjoying a fire. The commuters had gone by for the day, and it was just wonderfully quiet. All you could hear was the bugs. And I said, isn't it peaceful and wonderful out here? My niece's response was, no, it's kind of eerie. And so it really made me think about the people in the city and what they miss and what they have absolutely no idea what goes on out here, how the life is. And they're used to sirens, lights, constant activity, but the bugs and the corn was eerie. So that's all I wanted to say, and thank you. It's a wonderful show.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Harold, and good luck with your chicken barn. It's not a great day to be out building, so I hope it goes well.
It's been good. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. We have a lot of people who want to share their stories. Sonia is on the line next from Iowa City. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm good. What's your story?
Well, I moved here from Croatia in 1968. And we moved out to the farm. Well, I call it a farm because it sounds better, but it's actually 10 acres. And it was a homestead at one time, and I bought the house because it had this enormous hydrangea growing on the north side of the house. I figured I could deal with the house in time, but the trees, the oak trees, the fruit trees, my raspberry patch, which I harvest in my PJs in the morning, just could not be replaced in my lifetime. And so we have been living out here on our little 10 acres, absolutely delighted. I haven't gone quite so far as to have sheep and chickens and all that. But, you know, if I had to, I can do it. So that's just really delightful, and that's all I wanted to share.
Oh,
and the coyotes. Wonderful.
Oh, Sonia, thank you so much for your call. And that takes us back, Karen, to talking about those wonderful flowers on these old homesteads. And you actually, you had a little theft involving a hydrangea, I believe, in your past.
Well, yes, my sister and I sort of snuck into a cemetery and took some blooms. And, you know, it was under the cloak of darkness and that type of thing. Yeah, it was bad. We shouldn't talk about it.
Right.
Don't do it. Don't do it. I don't advocate it.
But it's wonderful to hear Sonia say that she was moved to buy the house simply by a hydrangea. It's a good thing she looked at a certain time of the year to see.
They're awfully nice.
Right, right. Dave is on the line next from Marshalltown. Hi, Dave.
Hey, hi.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, Karen and I worked together briefly back in the 90s. I'll let her relate the story about the arduous interview process. But I live on 6 acres of reclaimed cornfield south of Marshalltown. And I used to travel about the country representing the company that I was working for. And one time in Boston, in fact, I was taken out to dinner by the president of the company. And just making conversation over the dinner, he asked me, "So, what is it? Why do you choose to live out there in rural Iowa?" Because I was working as an engineer. And I have to admit, I was nonplussed at the time, but he did me a big favor because I thought about that and finally concluded that my pat answer to that question, which did come up from time to time, was it's for the lack of things, the lack of congestion, the lack of stress, the lack of hassles. You forget when you live out in the country and your commute is maybe 20 minutes by bicycle or you know, a short drive in the car. The issues with living in a place like Boston, where you know you sit for hours at a time in traffic, etc. And I don't know if I coined the term or not, but on my website I decided to declare myself a Midwestern chauvinist. So I've kind of taken that tack since that time.
Well, that's such an interesting point, Dave, because of course people talk about wanting to live in the cities because they're so close to things. And when you live in rural Iowa, you're far away from things, but you can get places a lot faster.
Well, and, you know, I question, too, whether or not people who live in, say, you know, New York City or something like that, yes, you can go to some first-class productions, et cetera, but I question how frequently they take advantage of that given the hassles of it. Okay, I live, you know, like 35 miles from Ames. Now, distance-wise, that's greater than a lot of your average city dwellers might have to go to a concert or something, but in terms of difficulty, no, not really. People just don't think about it in those terms when you live in a city.
Well, Dave, thanks a lot for your call. And like I said, we have a lot of people who want to share their stories, so we're going to move on. Melody is on the line next. Neera Tumwa. Hi, Melody.
Hi.
Hi. What did you want to talk about?
I wanted to tell you about a magical thing that happened. I live in the country south of Ottumwa on 5 acres. And last summer, my house sits up on a hill. And as I look down to the hill, there's the pond. So as you look out, there's an incredible amount of air space, you know, because we're up high. And last summer when the lightning bugs were out, all of that air space was filled with lightning bugs. And it was just magical. The only thing I could think of was Harry Potter. It looked like something from a Harry Potter movie. It was so incredible. You just don't find that in town.
No, no. Melody, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
And we got an email. This is from Angela. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but her husband really wants to move out to the country, and she's having second thoughts about it. So she has a couple of questions for you. And one is, are you ever lonely, Karen?
Well, that's where all those animals come in. You know, we're not lonely. We have the dogs, you know. Our kids have actually have gone to college and live elsewhere now, but we used to have a house full of kids all the time. But no, I would say I've never been lonely there.
She also wants to know if you moved out there before you had kids.
Yes, we did. Or I did, yeah.
She has several kids. She has 5 kids, and she's wondering about their adjustment to living in the country. So your kids didn't have to go through that adjustment, but you did. What's your take on that?
You know, I suppose it would depend on the kids and the ages of the kids, of course. But, you know, if you can get kids to slow down and just take a look at stuff, you know, I mean, we have kids come and stay with us all the time. Friends of ours will come. And there are a lot of things that they just aren't privy to, or they just haven't experienced. And you know, we had one kid come, and he wanted to collect eggs, and he, you know, then wanted to eat them all. And it's like, I don't think you should eat 12 eggs for breakfast, but you can if you want, you know. It's funny because a friend of mine in Portland, she says that was her. Whenever they talk about going on a trip anywhere, they're like, we could go to Paris, we could go to Hawaii, and basically he wants to come back to our farm and do stuff, you know.
Oh,
so
that's
kind of nice.
Yeah. So now that you have all of this time and experience to look back on, and a couple of decades living in rural Iowa, if I've done my math right, how would you say it's shaped you as a person?
Well, I think that living in a place that you appreciate and that you feel comfortable in is really important. And I do feel comfortable in the country, and I feel comfortable in cities as well. But I think that having a sense of place is very important. And I think everyone has sort of an internal landscape that sort of makes them feel comfortable or makes them feel happy. And, you know, I think that Iowa is just mine.
You travel a lot, so you interact with people all over the world. And I'm sure you've gotten the question that Dave was talking about earlier. Why do you live in Iowa? What do you tell people?
Well, you know, because it's beautiful. I mean, why does anyone live, you know, anywhere that they choose? I mean, you live places that, you know, hopefully you live in a place that makes you happy. And so I, you know, say that it just makes me happy. It's where I feel comfortable. And frankly, I don't think that we could have the type of lifestyle that we have if we lived, say, on either coast, because everything would be so much more expensive. You know, our house would be like $1 million in California, and it's not. It's not here, you know, and the land, too. You know, we have access to so much availability to open spaces and to land here that is just sort of unprecedented, you know, on either coast.
You've been in Iowa through a lot of changes. And of course, you grew up in Iowa, so you remember what things were like then. As you look at how things are changing, you write about local food and how you try to produce about half of what you eat on your own farm. When you look at the changes that are taking place right now in Iowa, what makes you feel optimistic about the future?
Well, I think it's very exciting because I think people are much more in touch with food and where it comes from than they've ever been. The fact that there's things like the slow food movement or the farmers market in Des Moines is just amazing. And you can, you know, go on a Saturday morning and just buy about anything. And I think also it just the idea that people are more interested in vegetable gardening and herb gardening, and that's a big trend that's increasing. I think that all bodes well, because I think the more you know about where your food comes from and how it's raised, you value it more and you're more careful about what you eat.
Karen, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Karen Weir Jimerson is the author of So Much Sky, Essays on the Fun and Folly of Living in the Country. She's also the author of the Slow Lane column for Country Gardens magazine. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese and Alex Hoyer. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today comes from John Pemble in Des Moines. You can send us email anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, discovering your family history, we're going to talk about genealogy. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.